So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam translations and purports by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. First canto, 19th chapter, 35th text.
Api me bhagavan prita.
Api me bhagavan prita.
Api me bhagavan prita.
Api me bhagavan prita.
Krishna pandu sutta.
Lord Krishna, the personality of Godhead, who is very dear to the sons of King Pandu, has accepted me as one of those relatives just to please his great cousins and brothers. Responsibly, Lord Krishna,
Lord Krishna,
the personality of Godhead,
personality of Godhead,
who is very dear to the sons of King Pandu,
has accepted me
as one of those relatives.
Just to please
his great cousins and brothers.
His great cousins and brothers.
Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Purport. A pure and exclusive devotee of the Lord serves his family interests more dexterously than others who are attached to illusory family affairs. Generally, people are attached to family members, and the whole economic impetus of human society is moving under the influence of family affection. Such deluded persons have no information that one can render better service to the family by becoming a devotee of the Lord. The Lord gives special protection to the family members and descendants of a devotee, even though such members are themselves non-devotees! Exclamation point. Maharaj Prahlad was a great devotee of the Lord, but his father, Hiranyakashipu, was a great atheist and declared enemy of the Lord. But despite all this, Hiranyakashipu was awarded salvation due to his being the father of Maharaj Prahlad. The Lord is so kind that he gives all protection to family members of his devotee, and thus the devotee has no need to bother about his family members, even if one leaves such family members aside to discharge devotional service. Maharaj Yudhisthira and his brothers were the sons of Kunti, the paternal aunt of Lord Krishna, and Maharaj Parikshit admits the patronage of Lord Krishna because of his being the only grandson of the great Pandavas. Sri Chaitanya Vistam Stapitam Je Bhutre Svayam Pakramayam Tarati Svapadantikam. So this word Gotra is used here in the first Gotrasya of the descendant. Some people say that they're all related to Krishna. People do their gotras or their brahmins, or they have some cousins or relatives. That's prevalent in India. Sometimes people have family spiritual masters or family gurus. Sometimes they're called seminal gurus. Those aren't the kind of gurus that are the liberating kinds, but they're part of a family tradition. And in some temples, like Puri, Jagannath Puri, and Tirupati. In Tirupati, if you are a Westerner and you're wearing Western clothes, you have to sign a declaration saying I'm Hindu before you can go inside. If you're a Hare Krishna Westerner, then you don't have to sign it. But if you try to go into the Puri temple, even as a Hare Krishna Westerner, you can't get in, because they don't consider you to be a bona fide Hindu. I have one friend who's born in the United States, but his parents were born in India. He looks very Indian, but when he went into the Jagannath Puri temple, they asked him what his gotra was, and he didn't know what the word gotra meant. He said, "I don't know." So he said, "Well, then you can't come in." And there was another devotee of Indian extraction who was wearing the neckpiece of Hare Krishna's, and as soon as the pandas saw that he was wearing those, they were forbidden to come into the temple. They didn't let him come in because he was associated with ISKCON, because they think, most of them, that it's kind of a tradition that the ISKCON people are contaminated because they are associating with people who don't have gotras, but they're from the West. And so there's a kind of barrier to letting them come into the temple. Although many who are Indians who are Muslims come in, they're certainly not Hindus, but it's a very kind of unusual, ironic situation there. They say it's changing, but there are many, over 100 Pandavas, hundreds maybe, who have this tradition of sort of not letting non-Hindu or Hindus who are contaminated, they think, by influence of the Malechas and Chandals of the West, not to come into the temple. One devotee put a dark, I think it was charcoal, Govindadasi, all over her face and hands and feet, and she was able to actually go into the temple. And when she offered her obeisances, though, they saw that the bottoms of her feet were white, so they chased her out with sticks. On the other hand, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj was able to go into the temple. He's very dark, and was actually, they thought he was from South India, and they just took him up to touch the feet of Lord Jagannath. So it's a very strange situation. It's a very holy place, actually. It is said that the residents of Puri seem forehanded by the residents of higher planetary systems, and yet, through the influence of Kali Yuga, some of the people who control the temple of Pandas are very averse to non-Hindus or Westerners coming into that temple. Very strange situation. Of course, Prabhupada said that we would have our own temple, and Bhuvaneshwar, which is very near Puri, is a beautiful temple there, and anyone can go in, and it's becoming very popular. In fact, sometimes it's said that more people come to the Calcutta Rath Yatra than go to the Puri Rath Yatra. I don't know if that's true, but a lot of people do come to it. And Lord Jagannath is very proudly displayed, and he's being worshipped by many Westerners. There was a time a few years back, the Kirti Raj told me, when the Rath Yatra festival was taking place in Puri, when a lot of the ISKCON devotees were there from Russia and other countries, they were light-skinned. And because they weren't in the temple per se, they were able to chant before the shrine of Lord Jagannath, and many of the guards sort of created a cordon around them, protected them, and let them chant for about an hour. So maybe things are changing, but the gotra is traditionally considered important because it has to do with the ancestors, the posterity, the future generations. So we'll talk about it a little bit because this is addressed in this verse, and Prabhupada addresses it in his purports. What we mean by doing the best service for the family. Prabhupada gives the example of the unfaithful housewife who is meditating constantly on her lover, but she's doing all her housework very diligently to convince her husband or to keep him from thinking that she is anything but very faithful to him, and she is doing her housework better than others. So this is a bit of an unusual example of how someone who becomes very devoted to Krishna is very diligent in duties that may not be related to Krishna, are very diligent in ordinary duties. So how does this relate to our sort of daily lives? Well, first of all, we can understand that from Prabhupada's personal existence, his personal life, and he seems to be talking about himself here, but when he says that even if one leaves such family members aside to discharge devotional service, he gets the mercy of the Lord. and the family members get protected. So there was that incident we saw in the video where Prabhupada left his wife behind because she wasn't interested in Krishna consciousness. So the message here is that even one may do something like this in a situation that is not conducive to Krishna consciousness, the family members are greatly benefited. And we read in the Srimad Bhagavatam there, given liberation as Hiranyakashipu, even though he wasn't a devotee, not only not a devotee, but he was a very inimical devotee, very demonic. And still, he was given liberation because he was a family member. So this is kind of a way of explaining how Krishna's mercy is causeless, how he, just like the rain, rains on the rocks, rains on the sea and the rocks get no benefit from the rain like the fields, which nurture the plants, they get a lot of benefit. But Krishna's mercy, like the rain, is causeless. He is very disposed to his devotees and very eager to see the ancestors and the posterity, generations 12, 50, 100, it's mentioned in the ways, are recipients of liberation, they get liberated. Of course, as a devotee, one understands that it is not only through Krishna's mercy, but through our own personal inspiration and our own personal example and our own personal endeavors that family members become liberated. Sometimes we see it happens between husband and wife, between son and or daughter and father and mother, or between father and mother and son and daughter. We have so many now generations, sometimes two or three generations in Krishna consciousness. And it is said in the Bhagavatam that one should not consider becoming a father or mother, husband, wife, or shudanga, spiritual master, or teacher, unless one can liberate one's charges from death. So to liberate from death means that there must be constant teaching and training of Krishna consciousness, constant bonds of sambandha, a relationship, that enable one to inspire others to become Krishna conscious, to realize that there is no other shelter in the world except for Krishna. That kind of nurturing is very, very important. So, for example, in the city, it's very inspiring to me to come here, because I'm based in a temple in America that, like many temples in the United States, have become a bit, we might say, like ghostly, but like ghost towns. Their founders have gone to other countries. That's part of the reason. And so, although Krishna consciousness in one sense started in America, it's been very neglected in many of the temples. And the preaching has sort of lost its spirit. It's coming back. Certainly it's on the way up now, I think. But this temple in Potomac, Maryland, which is just outside of Washington, which is the nation's capital, has not a lot of, it was sort of very derelict in a lot of ways, the building. And I think it's one of those temples like Hawaii, it's had maybe 12 or 18 presidents in the last few, 10 years or so. So it's been very left behind in so many ways. And of course, it's coming back. It's turned the corner, so to speak, like many have. But it's very inspiring to see how here in Auckland, you have some nice preaching programs here at the temple, at the law, which I was able to visit the other day, at your Food for Life Center, and on hot groups. The festivals, of course, are very nice. And some of you in your homes, you have preaching programs. So it's very inspiring to see how there's different types of outreach programs, different groups of people. It's important that preaching be tailored to the various audiences. Is there anything I left out, some other programs? Book distribution, probably the most important one. So reaching all kinds of people, and I think in Auckland, Devamir was telling me that the set distribution is bigger here than just about any place. Maybe second in the world, is that fair? It's very, very extraordinary. So in different ways, people are coming, and I think there is a plan, a hope, to have a restaurant here in Auckland to increase the preaching that way, because many people will come. There was a letter that Prabhupada wrote in 1974, it was actually a directive he gave to his secretary, who at that time was holding Sumal Krishna Maharaj. And that letter, famous letter, was kind of a directive. He had it sent out to, especially to the GDC members, that in America, he said, we have enough temples, we should now not open any new temples, but maintain the temples we have, but we should open restaurants with attached greeting rooms. This was Prabhupada's idea. It's kind of like the love program we have here, a little bit, you know, something like that. We have a restaurant. And he said that people will like this because they will appreciate the cultural position of Krishna consciousness. So that was a very interesting idea, that you have restaurants where you have a lot of people coming, they have to pay more than would come to a temple. They wouldn't get the full weight of Krishna consciousness blossom, maybe they might get a little of the spiritual atmosphere and the prasada and some of the books. And then adjacent to the restaurant, you'd have a reading room, which people could just come and sit down and have a library of books. And of course, nowadays, that means they'd be able to watch videotapes, be able to hear audio tapes, and so on. But basically, they'd be able to come in and sit down and read. As these, I think Christian Science have reading rooms around the door. People come in and they just read, and they become philosophically interested. Of course, in reading rooms, there would be devotees who would help them and guide them and so on. But this was Prabhupada's idea. And it's very effective. Wherever there are restaurants, and wherever there are little reading rooms, I don't know if there's any exactly in that format. But people do. In fact, in the restaurants, you'll see them reading books if they're on the book racks as they come in. In some restaurants, they just, the same people come in and they read the books time after time. Very interesting. So, Prabhupada says that this is the best service we can do for our family, is to become a devotee. And the recommendation is that all family members, they sit together, they have deities, they worship the deities, they eat prasadam, they read together, they go to the temple, they accommodate visiting guests who are Krishna conscious. They offer everything, ideally, to Krishna. They speak about Krishna to their friends, they take part in Krishna events. And in this way, the whole atmosphere becomes very spiritual. So Prabhupada didn't want just one temple in a big city like this, but he wanted many temples. He wanted, in fact, every home to be the temple, we might say, with deities in the home. He even spoke of creating deities, manufacturing deities on mass, such that they could be made out of cloth, they could be made out of metal, especially Gaurantai deities. And he even said that they should be put in a little box. This directive is recorded in the Prabhupada conversation books. And in the little box, you could have directions about how to worship these, what he called dolls. And he said that in the instructions, you could specify that incense could be lit and waved in front of the dolls, and there could be a little prayer of kind of glorification offered to the dolls, and the food could be offered to them. And he said then that you could ask the doll anything you want, and it would give you anything you wish. Of course, this is very material, and not recommended that we should make Krishna our order supplier by asking him for anything we wish. But it was the idea to get people to understand that there is a supreme controller, that there is God, and that in a very elementary way, that we can see God in a very beginning way, as he who can award all benedictions. It's one of the features of Krishna, he can award us all benedictions. So he thought, and I saw when I was in France once, someone was reading a newspaper, and it was a very crowded subway train that I was in. I was reading a newspaper, and I couldn't help noticing, looking over someone's shoulder, it was not very polite, but someone had a page open, and there was a big, that looked, I thought it was Krishna, but it was a Lakshmi. It was some kind of an image of a Lakshmi with a pedestal, a base, and she was standing there in a very, looking like a very Indian type of drawing, in a very traditional sense. This was the goddess Lakshmi. And the ad was, someone was translating it for me, I don't read French very well, that you could send away with some money, send a certain number of francs, and this Lakshmi figure, about 18 inches high, would be delivered to you. And it would make your home very sanctified and auspicious, and you could ask for benedictions from Lakshmi. So I thought that was very interesting. Anyway, Prabhupada somehow, without ever seeing such an ad, had the idea that these little Gaurantais could be in every home, in everyone's house, all over the world, and they could, by offering incense and food, they could begin the process of worshiping. So the idea was that every home should be a temple, and every home should be sanctified. So Krishna is very merciful. We were discussing a little bit the other day about what is our karma, and how karma is eradicated and corrupted, and how much we have to suffer. And is it actually karma, or is it Krishna taking things away from us? And I was mentioning that there's a very nice passage in the 10th canto. The purports were rendered by Kriyatana Maharaja company. And especially to that verse, Tatena Brahmansu Sumishimana. So I thought that what I would do as part of this morning's class is read from the purports, which are quotations from Sri Araswami and others, giving us a little more insight into what the meaning of this verse is and how much we have to suffer or not suffer according to our karma. So this is very interesting. Translation and purport. So if you don't mind indulging me, I'll read this. This is from the 10th canto, 14th chapter. It's the 8th verse, Tateya Kampam Sisamishamango. Ujjayi Vatma Kritam Vipakam Vipakva Kubir Vidadam Namaste Jivetsi Omukti Padesa Daiva. Translation is like this. My dear Lord, one who earnestly waits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him. This is actually Prabhupada's translation. All the while patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds and offering your respectful obeisances with his heart, words, and body is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim. And this is the purport. Srila Sridhar Swami explains in his commentary that just as a legitimate son has to simply remain alive to give an inheritance from his father, one who simply remains alive in Krishna consciousness, following the regulated principles of Bhakti Yoga, automatically becomes eligible to receive the mercy of the personality of Godhead. In other words, he will be promoted to the kingdom of God. The word Susamishamana indicates that a devotee earnestly awaits the mercy of the Supreme Lord, even while suffering the painful effects of previous sinful activities. Lord Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that a devotee who fully surrenders unto him is no longer liable to suffer the reactions of his previous karma. However, because in his mind a devotee may still maintain the remnants of his previous sinful mentality, the Lord removes the last vestiges of the enjoying spirit by giving his devotee punishments that may sometimes resemble sinful reactions. The purpose of the entire creation of God is to rectify the living entity's tendency to enjoy without the Lord, and therefore the particular punishment given for a sinful activity is specifically designed to curtail the mentality that produced the activity. Although a devotee has surrendered to the Lord's devotional service, until he is completely perfect in Krishna consciousness, he may maintain a slight inclination to enjoy the false happiness of this world. The Lord therefore creates a particular situation to eradicate this remaining enjoying spirit. This unhappiness suffered by a sincere devotee is not technically a karmic reaction. It is rather the Lord's special mercy for inducing his devotee to completely let go of the material world and return home back to Godhead. A sincere devotee earnestly desires to go back to the Lord's abode. Therefore, he willingly accepts the Lord's merciful punishment and continues offering respects and obeisances to the Lord with his heart, words, and body. Such a bona fide servant of the Lord, considering all hardship a small price to pay for gaining the personal association of the Lord, certainly becomes a legitimate son of the Lord, as indicated here by the word Dayapa. Just as one cannot approach the sun without becoming fire, one cannot approach the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Pure Lord Krishna, without undergoing a rigid purificatory process, which may appear like suffering, but which is in fact a curative treatment administered by the personal hand of the Lord. So that's a very insightful way to understand what we have to sometimes suffer, and that we have to sometimes suffer, even though we have undertaken the path of Krishna consciousness as our primary focus in life, that sometimes there is what we might call residual karma. We can have some discussions on that. Also, I want to read another passage because it's come up from time to time. I think it's one of our classes about the meaning of a guru, and how it has become a very broad thing in the sense that Lord Chaitanya has instructed that every one of us become guru. Krishna Vadesh Mara Guru Mata Tara Edesh. It is incumbent upon all of us to become teachers. Just as we are parents, we have to become gurus. As we're devotees, we have to approach everyone. And there is a concept mentioned in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita in the Adi Lila, the 35th and 36th verses of the first chapter, about what a Shiksha Guru is and what a Diksha Guru is. We also have Partha Pradarshika Gurus. We have Partha Pradarshika Gurus. And many gurus. Once Prabhupada was approached by a stranger, and he was told that we could learn by children. The children are our gurus. And Prabhupada was sitting outside his residence in Montreal, Canada. This was in 1968. And we were sitting on the sidewalk, and Prabhupada was sitting in a chair. And this fellow just came up and sat down on the floor across the leg on the pavement. And he offered that, well, we have a lot to learn from the children. And Prabhupada said, no, not so much from children, but from dogs we have a lot to learn. And he was very shocked. How can we learn from dogs? And Prabhupada said, yes, from the dog we can learn fidelity. Because even if the master decides to shoot the dog will become faithful up until the moment the master pulls the trigger and kills him. So he was very shocked. The Prabhupada was just giving an example that we can learn from everything, not only human beings, but dogs. So, I want to read this passage from the 11th canto, the 7th chapter, when the Adhidhita Brahma is explaining how he's not only learning from the Shiksha and the Diksha Guru, but from other things. And he says, I won't read the Sanskrit, but he says that, O King, I have taken shelter of 24 gurus who are the following: the earth, sky, air, water, fire, moon, sun, pigeon, and python, the sea, moth, honeybee, elephant, and honeybee, the deer, the fish, the prostitute, pingala, the karara bird, and the child, so the camera from children, and the young girl, arrow maker, serpent, spider, and wasp. My dear King, by studying their activities, I have learned the science of the self. So I'm going to read some of this explanation and stuff in this session. Purport. The wasp is known as Supesha Preet because it causes the insect that it kills to take a beautiful form in the next life. Please listen, O son of Maharaja Yati, O tiger among men, as I explain to you what I have learned from each of these gurus. A sober person, even when harassed by other living entities, should understand that his aggressors are acting helplessly under the control of God, and thus he should never be distracted from progress on his own path. This rule I have learned from the earth. Purport. The earth is a symbol of tolerance. By deep oil drilling, atomic explosions, pollution, and so on, the earth is constantly harassed by demonic living entities. Sometimes lush forests are cut down by greedy men with commercial interests, and thus a wasteland is created. Sometimes the earth's surface is soaked by the blood of soldiers fighting in savage warfare. Yet despite all these disturbances, the earth continues to revive all necessities of the living beings. In this way, one may learn the art of tolerance by studying the earth. What's another symbol of tolerance, Lord Chaitanya's status? The tree. Why is the tree tolerant? What do we learn from the tree? Yes? Yes, even though people are hitting it with an axe, it doesn't scream, doesn't say, stop doing this to me. Very good. Very good. What else do we learn from the tree?
Take cold.
Yeah, even cold, it will stand in the cold snow and rain and wind and not protest. It, even if it doesn't get water, it doesn't protest. So trees, in many ways, great symbols of tolerance. I'll continue. Translation of the verse 38. A certain person should learn from the mountain to devote all his efforts to the service of others and to make the welfare of others the sole reason for his existence. Similarly, as the disciple of the tree, he should learn to dedicate himself to others. Great mountains are unlimited quantities of earth. which in turn gives sustenance to innumerable forms of life, such as trees, grass, birds, animals, and so on. Mountains also pour forth unlimited quantities of crystalline water in the form of waterfalls and rivers, and this water gives life to all. By studying the example of mountains, one should learn the art of providing for the happiness of all living entities. Similarly, one may take excellent lessons from the pious trees, who offer innumerable benefits, such as fruits, flowers, cooling shade, and medicinal extracts. Even when the tree is suddenly cut down and dragged away, the tree does not protest, but continues to give service to others in the form of firewood. Thus, one should become the disciple of such magnanimous trees and learn from them the qualities of saintly conduct. According to Śrīla Bhattacharya, the word parataikanta, sambhava, indicates that one should dedicate all of one's wealth and other assets to the welfare of others. By one's acquired opulence, one should especially try to please the spiritual master and the supreme personality of Godhead. Thus the demigods, as well as all truly respectable superior personalities, will automatically be pleased. By developing saintly conduct as described in this verse, one will become tolerant, and thus will free one from the useless agitation. And this will free one from the useless agitation of the material senses, which drive one to wander throughout the world searching in vain for material happiness. Though Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has also emphasized the tree's quality of tolerance, Sahara Ivas, Hishnana, Kirtaniya, Fadagari, one who is as tolerant as a tree can chant the holy name of Krishna constantly, finding ever new satisfaction. This is verse 39. A learned sage should take his satisfaction in the temple maintenance of his existence and should not seek satisfaction to gratify the material senses. In other words, one should care for the material body in such a way that one's higher knowledge is not destroyed and so that one's speech and mind are not deviated from self-realization. We'll read some more of these in the next class. Here's several other reports and verses. I have a little bit of time constraint, so we'll only have time for a couple of questions this morning, but if you'd like to, I'll try to answer. Yes?
Raj, you're explaining how Krishna gives us punishments to rectify our deviant. Mm. And I was wondering, how do you understand that Krishna gives material benedictions to devotees, but then the devotees are bringing and bringing association to devotees?
And we can learn that pride goeth before the fall, that Krishna does award benedictions for the sake of using those benedictions to give back to Krishna. And as a test that in times of well-being and wealth and auspiciousness and good things, we can use all these things for Krishna and not be enamored. And when devotees have been given many benedictions but have not used them or have succumbed to the material energy, that is being done as an example for that devotee, hopefully, to become reformed and for all of us to learn that material benedictions are not necessarily beneficial if they are not used in Krishna service. The example is given is it the ninth canto where Lord Shiva is attracted by Mohini Murti? I think so. Lord Shiva, who is considered to be absolutely sober, cannot be affected even by his consort touching his genitals, is attracted by the supreme, beautiful female form in the cosmos of Mohini Murti. Krishna takes on that form and Lord Shiva tries to embrace her. And Mohini Murti slips away from him, from his embrace, and runs away. And then Lord Shiva becomes entranced and starts running after her. And as he's running after her, he's passing Semana. And Mohini Murti is running before many great sages sitting in meditation. And all of a sudden they witness this bizarre spectacle of Lord Shiva chasing after this beautiful woman and losing his Semana. Of course, it is explained in purports by Srila Prabhupada, and I think in some ensuing verses, that this is not because Lord Shiva is attracted to the female gender or to female beauty, but because he has a very intimate relationship with Krishna. And Krishna arranged all of this to happen for the mind of Lord Shiva to be altered. He goes into an altered state by specific direction and arrangement by Lord Krishna, just so that the sages can see
how dangerous the material energy is. This is the lesson that is meant to be learned. So we have this lesson to learn also, that sometimes we see devotees are given great material facilities and they abuse those facilities. They become proud and they use them for material ends instead of for Krishna's end. And so we have a lot to learn when we see very advanced so-called people, and maybe they are for a time, but they get great benedictions and they abuse those benedictions. They don't use them for Krishna. So then it makes us think, well, then who am I? I have to be so careful because there is there's danger at every step. I may get some benediction, but this is my real test. If Krishna takes things away from me as a devotee, I'll feel, well, yes, that's Krishna taking everything away from me, so I'll feel more dependent on him. I'll look to him for protection more. I won't have any other interests. But when I get something valuable, something good, something new, a new house, a new car, a better situation, a better job, more money, and if I don't use that for Krishna, that is very dangerous because I will be tempted to use those things in a material way, my own satisfaction, my own personal benefits, rather than for Krishna's satisfaction. Yes?
Sometimes in that regard, it may seem that, you know how good that Krishna really gives us what we need, and it may work both ways. I see sometimes we give more than we're able to take, or less than we're able to take, and then we're vegan, so it seems like that test is too big. So it doesn't seem like Krishna isn't giving us the test that we're not able to pass.
Sometimes he does. I mean, it happens for the sake of learning. Generally, Krishna gives us what we need in order to advance in devotional service. In general, we have a temple. We need a temple. And it's, you know, he used to say that we have these nice big palaces in Europe that we have, and a place in Germany we have so many cars. But he was quick to say that we're not using all these cars for our own gratification. We're using them to preach, to go out into the places where the people are. So generally, Krishna gives us just what we need to preach. We need things, and we have to be careful about that we don't abuse them. Sometimes people have been given big positions and have not used those positions in the proper way. And Krishna's taken them away. So we do have to be on guard. But generally, devotees of Krishna are kept in poverty. Devotees of Lord Shiva are known to be more affluent, more opulent. The story of Rika Sura was told to show how benedictions can be abused and they're taken away in a very dramatic way sometimes. So I think we'll have to have a little on time or early, just in case maybe today. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada.